Thank you, Alan, for leading us this morning. And I echo Alan's welcome to visit us. So glad you could be with us. We'd have been so few without you, a few anyway, but so glad to have you with us. As Alan said, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at this series based on this passage that we've just read, A Church Worth Joining. And we've been looking at what it is about this church in Thessalonica that was so important, and what can we learn from them. And you see in that passage that this was a church that Paul said had a lot to commend them, and yet this wasn't probably a big church. I happened to be reading something else, nothing to do with this, just a couple of weeks back, and it made the comment that this church here in Thessalonica might not be as big as Forefront Community Church or the Baptist Church. It may have been very small in number. Sometimes we think of those big mega churches, particularly in the States, and what they're doing and all the resources that they have. But this was just probably a relatively small number of people. And yet their impact was huge, as we read about in that passage. So I just want us to look again this morning at what was it then about them that caused them to have such an impact on the world in which they lived. I was watching, this is rare, I know there's some folks who spend quite a bit of time doing this, but I happened to see some snooker on the television just the other week, one of the championships, and I can see why people get hooked onto it, and as I said, not particularly myself. As I was thinking about impact, I couldn't help but think of the impact in terms of, well, one of the things that came out, actually, they were interviewing one of the guys, one of these professionals, and he was talking, and they were talking about his game, and he happened to say during that, I know there are one or two here who probably do play the odd game of snooker or whatever else, he happened to say just how many hours he spent practicing on the table when the camera wasn't on him so that he could actually play the game when the camera was on him. You know, and that's important, isn't it? Because we tend so easily to look at the things on the outside, the things that are visible, the things that the big impact. We think in terms of methods and strategies and all these sorts of things. What we tend to not to focus so much about is what's going on behind the scenes that causes those things then to happen. And I was thinking about, and then I sort of got thinking about snooker, and I thought that snooker is a game in which there is impact. There's some snooker balls. But we all know, I'm sure you all know the basics of this game, that at the far end when you start off, there is a white ball, the cue ball. And the cue ball has to be propelled down to the end of this end of the table to break the reds, right? And there's an impact then, depending on how hard the ball is hit, the direction and all the rest of it, that there is an impact. And those balls go flying off. And of course, for me, they don't go anywhere, but for a professional, they go in just the right sort of places, and he knows exactly what he's aiming to do. And I was thinking, you know, that white ball is a bit like the church, that God sends out into the world to make an impact. And where those red balls end up, it's determined by where the white ball hits them and how hard it hits them. But you've then got to go back behind that and to say, where does the white ball go? Well, the white ball, well, why does it go? The white ball goes in that direction because of the one who holds the cue. And it's the power and the precision and the direction of the cue holder that determines where the white ball goes, provided the white ball is available to him to hit it where he needs to hit it and wants to hit it. Because sometimes the cue ball is not always available in the way that the snooker player wants it to be. And I thought that's a very important image as we think about making an impact, as the church thinks about making an impact. We need to think, first and foremost, are we available to Jesus Christ? Because he's the one that holds the cue. His is all the power. All the direction and all the rest of it comes from him. And that's what we were talking about last week when Dave talked about a church empowered by the Spirit, because that's what it says was true also for this church at Thessalonica. He is the head. He is the one that guides us. And yes, our methods, the way we do things is important. So therefore, we do use, we hope, our sanctified minds to organize things in certain ways. Therefore, things like CAP and the Lord's Larder and the men's work that we're talking about doing and all of those things are focused, right? They are important that we do them well, and they're done with clear intentions. The clear intention of the Lord's Larder, for instance, is twofold, isn't it? One is to meet people's emergency needs for food supplies. And that's important. I don't know about anybody else, but I saw two men this week, one of which said he had not eaten for several days, and the other one which said he had literally no money to buy any food. And I believe their stories, right? So there's a real need. But it isn't just that. It isn't just that, although that's absolutely valid and valuable in itself. But also, there is a hope. There's a hope that behind meeting people's physical needs, that they might wonder why we're doing it, right? And we might say, well, actually, the only reason we do this is because of what God has done in our hearts, and that he commands us and encourages us to love other people, as we've been hearing this morning. So we want to be focused in our methods. We want to do things that make sense, and we want to do them well. We want to have structure, right? We need to have structure. Church needs to be organized. There needs to be order in the way that things happen. There needs to be leadership and all those other things. So we need to have structure. But behind that, the church is not just an institution. It could have structure, and it could have good methods and strategies, and it could achieve nothing. That's what Jesus said. We don't like to hear that, perhaps. But what's true for us as individuals is true for us as a church, is that with all those things, even with all the resources that we possess, we could, at the end of the day, achieve absolutely zero if God is not working through these things. If God is not, as we talked about last week, if God is not empowering us as individuals and as a church, if it's not him, if it's not his life, it goes nowhere. That white ball will not impact the red balls as it should. And you know, and we need to be absolutely convinced about this. We need, therefore, to seek God. And we need, if we're honest, in this church and in many other churches, to seek God in ways that we've not sought him before. Because for too long, too often, the impact of the church has been very, very little. Nowhere like the impact that this group of believers made upon their world. Why is it? Is that because they had better methods, better structure? Is that because they had more resources? Absolutely no. They probably had less of some of those things. And yet they impacted more. And we're very quickly... But look at my watch. Very quickly going to look at more. And before I forget, because I've already forgotten to tell Alan and then forgotten as I stood up, there is no evening service tonight because of the weather. So got that. Remembered that one. Okay, a church that impacts the world. Two things that stand out. Let's read verses 6 to 8 again. You became imitators of us and of the Lord. In spite of severe suffering, you welcomed the message with the joy given by the Holy Spirit. And so you became a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. That's the whole of Greece, folks, those two provinces. The Lord's message rang out from you, not only in Macedonia and Achaia. Your faith in God has become known everywhere. That's pretty impressive for a small church. Your faith in God has become known everywhere. And there's two things that stand out there, M and M. First of all, they were a model. And secondly, they had a message. A model. A model is something that you can... I'm not talking about the catwalk variety now, although perhaps some of us would like to think particularly about that. So, Nash, shut up, Andrew. I'm thinking more of the model I'm thinking more of the model that you copy, something that you can see. Something that you can see how it fits together and you can copy it. Perhaps in the human sense, I'm thinking of the person who teaches you how to play a sport. Right? I mean, I can remember Paul. He didn't have much joy with me. I've seen Paul somewhere here this morning. Paul Drews. Oh, there he is. I can remember Paul trying to teach me to play badminton. Right? He gave up after a bit. But I can remember him even holding my hand with a badminton racket in it and showing me the direction and the angle of the particular shots. I'm talking about that sort of person who models it, who doesn't just tell you this is what you do, but actually demonstrate it. These people were a model. They had modeled themselves on Paul and his testimony. Paul had modeled himself on Christ, and they then themselves became a model that other people, other Christians, could see and learn from. That's why I want to develop mentoring within the church, in groups, but also one-to-one. And you might not know, but that's already happening in different ways. We want to do that because there's an importance in terms of modeling to each other. Secondly, they had a message. A message is something that you hear and understand. Sometimes we give mixed messages. I certainly do. This church gave a very clear message. I almost picture it like a gong, you know, when it's a really big gong. And it wasn't so long ago that I was somewhere where somebody hit one. You know, and that reverberation that goes out from it, that's what I think they were like. There was a clear note that was struck, and that note spread throughout Greece and beyond. We need instructions. I want ones that sort of I have to keep looking at slightly, or every so often these days, are cooking instructions as I try and learn to do even the basic. Why are cooking instructions so small, by the way? Is it? They need to print them a lot bigger, don't they? You get them up here and trying to read them. Anyway, we need a model and we need a message. And they had model and message, this church. That's why they impacted the world. When I used to make Airfix models, in fact, I've left my water down there. Excuse me, when I get talking, my lips start to stick together and it gets very difficult to talk when your lips are stuck together. Right, okay. I used to make Airfix models. I wasn't a good modeler, but the very fact that on the box there was a picture of the plane or whatever I was trying to make, and inside there were pictures that showed which bits went to which. Alongside that, there were written step-by-step instructions, meant that even somebody as careless and as not very clever like myself could make out what was needed. We need to be model and message, and the two go together. Martin Luther said, if I can find Martin Luther, every Christian should experience two conversions. The first is to respond to God's will to come out of the world. First is to come out, be ye separate, whatever. The second is to be sent back into the world with the message and the model of the kingdom of God. And I don't know if it was Martin Luther himself who went on or whether it was somebody quoting him, but they went on to say, the sad thing is that most of the church, or many of the church, do not hear the second call. And two go together. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus connected so strongly, didn't he, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul and all your mind. The two should not be separated. Very quickly, three ways in which this church then were the message and the model, the impact that they had. First of all, there was conviction. I don't know if we've got this. Have we jumped on? I think we've... Okay, all right. Let's go straight into this. I think we'll go back to another minute. Conviction. They had... I'm going to give you three C's now, very quickly. First of all, conviction. We read about the deep conviction that they had. They were convinced of the truth of the gospel. That's how they'd first received the gospel, came with words, but with power, with the Holy Spirit, and were convinced that this was the truth. Can you imagine how hard it was for Jews to believe that Jesus was the Christ? Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that the one that they knew as the creator of the world, the one that they knew had given they're given instructions to their forefathers, to Abraham, this great and holy God, this one that Moses could not even look at the face of. Can you imagine how hard it was for them to believe in the generations that went on after those first Jewish Christians, to believe that this God came down as a man and lived with them? And what's worse, that this man was of humble birth, and what's even worse than that he died on a cross. Can you imagine how hard that is for Jews to believe? That was blasphemous in the extreme. It was incredibly hard for Jews to believe later on that Jesus was the Christ. And yet they did. And when they did, they were absolutely convinced that this was the truth. And they believed three things about it. And we may disagree on some things, right? Let's make sure that we understand these three things and believe them, because they are critically important. We can disagree on some secondary issues. First of all, incarnation. They believed that Jesus, the historical Jesus Christ, the man Jesus Christ, was the same Christ of faith that they had to believe in those following centuries, that he was the Son of God and that he'd come down to this earth and he'd lived. Secondly, they believed in the atonement. They believed that what Christ had done for them by dying on the cross, that he took the punishment that was theirs so that they could be forgiven and free from their sins. They believed in the resurrection. That's one of the early messages, isn't it? You read in Acts. That comes out time and time again, that this Jesus who you killed, God has raised from the dead. And they believed that he was now at the right hand of God the Father in heaven, and that he would return. They believed these things. They were absolutely convinced that these were true. Conviction leads to mission. Because I ask myself, if we believe those things are true, what sort of people would we be? If we believe those things are true, what sort of people would we be? You see, I had a dad, you'll be surprised about that, will you? I had a dad, and he was very mild-mannered, very passive sort of guy. My mum was quite fiery, I understand, and I'm the perfect balance, because I'm just there in the middle, yeah? Right, not at all, but... My dad was passive, he didn't easily get upset. I tell you one thing that did upset him. He used to get upset when he heard Christians on the radio, particularly clergy or bishops, denying the faith. When he heard people saying that they didn't believe in miracles, or they didn't believe in the virgin birth or the resurrection, and these were ministers of the gospel, he used to get really angry about that. He'd say, and this is why it stuck with me, he'd say, I don't mind those people having those opinions, but they should leave the church. They should not be standing out there as members of the church, clergy and bishops, giving those views. They should get out. Then they can say whatever they like. Do you know, I'm not so sure that there's not even a greater danger for us who say we believe. You with me? Can you see why? You see, in our church, and in the Baptist church, and at Bishopswood, whatever, we say we believe these things. We say it. The question is, do we? Are we really convinced that this is the truth? Or are they just something up there, out there? Because if it is, deep conviction will lead to mission. And I just want to read to you what was written by a guy called Calcius in the second century. He was a pagan, not a Christian. And he wrote this. I came across this just recently. He said in one of his writings, it was the wool workers, the cobblers, the laundry workers, and the most illiterate and bucolic yokels, that's his actual words, the most illiterate and bucolic yokels, who carried the gospel forth. even more than the bishops, the apologists, and the theologians. You see, these ordinary people were so convinced it was true, so convinced that Jesus was who he said was he was, and that he was therefore coming back, that they took the gospel everywhere. That's how the church grew so fantastically in those first two centuries. It was ordinary people like us, not professionals, not the bishops. I'm sure they had their part, but who carried it forward. I think it was C.S. Lewis, wasn't it, who said something like this: Christianity, if false, is of no value. We should be all out sledging, right, this morning. We could be doing far better things. You could do far better things than listening to me, I'm sure. If it's false, it's of no value. But if it's true, and he went on to say it's something like, it's worth everything. Everything. I always remember that story of, I think the criminal was called Charlie Peace, I'm not sure. The criminal who was on prison and he was about to be executed for murder. And a priest visited him. And he did, offered to do the last rites or whatever else with him. Offered to pray with him. And Charlie Peace said, he got angry and he said to this priest, he told him to go away. He said, get out of here. Get out. He said, because if I believed what you say you believed, I would crawl across England on my hands and knees, even if it was covered in broken glass, to tell people what you say you believe. And there's some very serious things there for us to think about, isn't it? Very quickly, we might not get to the third C. Here's the second one, character. These were changed people. These Christians were very different, and it showed in their character. And we've looked in previous weeks, we've looked at their works produced by faith. We've looked at their labor prompted by love. Let's just stop on that one, labor prompted by love. These people were motivated by love to do extraordinary things. Here's a text, again from the second century, written by a Christian this time, Dionysius of Alexandria. It's all right, you can tell I've read a book on Christian history not so long ago. But I love this. He wrote this: the best of our brethren, some presbyters, priests, deacons, and many of the laity that were exceedingly commended, transferred death to themselves. Transferred death to themselves, because this was written during the plagues of the second century, where many died. They took up the bodies of the saints with their open hands and on their bosoms. They cleaned their eyes and closed their mouths, and they carried them on their shoulders, embraced and clung to them, and prepared them decently for burial. And he goes on to say, and before long, those same people shared in the same offices, those that survived, always following those that had died before them. Do you see what he's saying? And then he goes on to contrast this with what was happening generally at that time, where people, when anyone was seen as sick, immediately they were pushed out of the community because they realized that these things were spreading person to person. So even one's dearest friends, maybe even one's family, he was saying, were excluded. And yet these Christians, when they saw people were dying in their own families and in the Christian community, they went to them, they carried them, they cleaned them, they buried them, and then they died after them. Can you imagine the impact that that had on communities when they saw this happening? Can you imagine that? I just want to ask you, if AIDS could be caught by touch and through globules in the air or whatever else, how many of us as Christians would be willing to work with AIDS people, knowing that just by being with them that we could catch it? How many of us? And yet that's what these people were doing. I always loved that story that Ron told about the guy, the missionary, who went and worked on an island which was a leprosy colony. And week after week he preached to these people He lived with them. And then one day, he got up. That was a real incarnation, wasn't it? He lived with them. One day he got up and he said, "Today, I truly am one of you." Because he caught leprosy. Are we willing to be those people? Perhaps not in those great big dramatic ways, but are we willing to be people who will do things prompted by love, endurance inspired by hope? I'm going to finish here. I'll leave community for the next for next week when I'm also preaching. This church in Thessalonica, what we read in Acts 17, was born in persecution, right? Right from the very start, they were hit by outside opposition in a very real and very direct way. These people were an offense. These Christians were an offense to the Jews, as I already said, who saw this as really blasphemous, the things that they were saying about the Jesus Christ being God. They were an offense to the Greeks and the Romans, who were quite happy for you to believe in whatever gods you wanted. But unfortunately, these Christians were saying that this Jesus Christ is the one and only true God. That did not go down well with people who believed in many, many deities. If they'd only said he was one, they wouldn't have any one of many. They wouldn't have had any problems whatsoever. That was quite normal in the Greek and Roman worlds, as we know. But these people, because of these things, were persecuted by Jews and by Greeks and by Romans for what they were saying they believed. And yet they didn't just endure suffering. It says here, didn't it, in the passage, they welcomed the message with joy. They welcomed the message with joy. They took the words of Jesus that when he said that blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They took them, and as Paul did, they believed it was a privilege and an honor to be persecuted because of the hope that they had within them. Imagine how that translated into their world. And today there are many Christians throughout this world who are persecuted for their faith. They don't get the education for their children. They don't get the jobs they should get. They don't, perhaps not even allowed where they want to live. And worse than that, they are physically or verbally and physically abused. And today, in our world, there will be many Christians who die. More in the last century than the previous 19 centuries all added together, is what those who work in these fields believe. It's real. It's not real for us because it's not part of our experience and we find it difficult to understand. But that's how it was. But just as the writer Tertullian said also in the second century, he said, "The oftener we are mowed down by you, the more in number we grow. The blood of Christians is seed." See that? The blood of Christians is seed. These people had a character. Sometimes the people that were executing them were converted because they saw the way that these people endured. They heard them singing hymns as they went into the amphitheaters, mothers and fathers and children together, singing songs of praise as they were led into Roman amphitheaters. They saw people been used as human torches by Nero in his gardens just because they were Christians. They saw the way they died as well as the way they lived. And it was fantastic in terms of the impact that it made. There are two things, their convictions, they believed the gospel was true, their character that was reflected in the way that they lived. And community, as I said, which is such an important thing we'll look at next week. They weren't told to be like this. They weren't given a list of regulations that said, or instructions that said, this is Christians what you must do. Right? They did these things because of God's Holy Spirit working in their lives, showing them the sort of lives that he wanted them to lead. And they had a huge impact and the world in those first few centuries. Things started to go a bit downhill after it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. Perhaps it should never have. Maybe things would have been different. But anyway, the question is, they made an impact. Do we as a church want to make an impact? Because if we do, it isn't about, fundamentally, it isn't about having good programs, although I hope they are. It isn't about having a good structure in the way that we're organized, although that's important and necessary. Fundamentally, it's about each and every one of us saying that we want to be available as the white ball for God to use in the direction that he wants to send us and with the power that he wants to send us. That will mean in terms of what we do collectively and what we do individually, both in church and in the places where we live and work. If we have a deep conviction that the gospel is true, if we have lives where our characters are being changed so that people can see the sort of people that God is making us to be, and if finally, which we haven't talked about, if we're the community and live as the people that God wants us and how he wants us to live together, then the impact will happen. It will happen. We don't have to think about particularly about some of the outworkings of that. It will just happen. Do you want that to happen? Because the truth is that God could do exactly the same with us as he did with them, if only we'd be willing and available to him.